Hello, my name is Lou Cody from CuriousCity.com, and you're listening to the Curious About Filmmaking podcast. Today's show is recorded in partnership with the International Screenwriters Association, and you can check them out at networkisa.org. There you'll find all kinds of free resources about screenwriting, information about contests, more podcasts, teleconferences, more articles and tips, and the ISA will connect you with people like today's amazing guest, Steve Kaplan. So for almost 20 years, Steve has been in the industry most respected and sought after expert on comedy. In addition to having taught at UCLA, NYU, and Yale, Steve created the HBO Workspace, the HBO New Writers Program, and was co-founder and artistic director of Manhattan Punchline Theater. He has served on as a consultant to such companies as DreamWorks, Disney, Aardman Animations, HBO, and others. In addition to private coaching and one-on-one consultations, Steve has taught his comedy intensive workshop to thousands of students around the world, including Los Angeles, New York, Toronto, London, Australia, New Zealand, Ireland, Sweden, and Singapore. I think there's you almost hit everything out there, Steve, so welcome.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much.
So the first thing I want to jump into is, I have so many questions for you, but when I was taking a look at your book, and you're kind of talking about your origin story as a comic or comedian, comedic writer, I should say. And you talked about how you preferred the Marx Brothers over the Three Stooges when you were a kid. And I'm really curious of like why was your sensibility that way, and what about that kind of tells you people what kind of comedy you like?
Well, you know, when I was a kid, I wasn't really conscious that there was something wrong with the Three Stooges. All I knew is that I only liked Shemp, really. Because Shemp was the one who, to me, had heart. You know, I still remember the Three Stooges episode in which Shemp dies and is an angel. And I thought that was so sweet. And otherwise, you know, Moe just kind of reminded me of the bullies who beat me up. You know, they just hit me and they had no pleasure out of it other than hitting me. So I think as I grew older, I realized that the comedy that I was drawn to is comedy that both has a brain and heart, that isn't just noise for noise's sake, isn't just slapstick for the sake of a slap, but is a comedy like Groundhog Day or 40-Year-Old Virgin or, you know, or The Office, especially the British Office, Fawlty Towers, you know, comedies that are anarchic, crazy, funny, but also have a thought in their head and have, you know, have a heart and tries to do what I try to do in my work, which is tell the truth about human beings. Because to me, that's what comedy does. Comedy tells the truth about human beings. Now, that's not to put down drama. Drama is great. I mean, drama helps us dream about what we can be. Would that we were as good-looking as somebody on a soap, or as soulful as a Shakespearean actor. But comedy helps us live with who we are, and you can tell a lot of stories in terms of comedy that just encompass the entire range of human emotion and experience. To me, that's what great art and great theater is. It's telling the truth about people.
You mentioned a couple of British series, and you mentioned the British version of The Office and also Fawlty Towers, which my brother turned me on to when we were young, and I didn't get it at first, and then something clicked, and I thought it was one of the funniest shows that I'd ever seen. What is it about? I guess we'll start with British humor, but you've taught all over the world. I'm very curious how what you've experienced as far as people's different comedic sensibilities in different cultures. But I want to first ask you, what is it about British humor I'm going to make some broad comments here, but some Americans find extremely funny and others do not. And what is it about the British humor that strikes people that like it as being so funny?
Well, I don't understand why people don't like things like Fawlty Towers or The Office. So I can't really psychoanalyze those people. Maybe they're all busy watching Two and a Half Men. I'm not sure. I have to actually, give a caveat, because when I talk about British series, I'm talking about the best series that they've ever done, and we only get to see the best. So when I go over to Britain, they're not happy with the state of their sitcoms. They actually think that us Yanks do it better. I mean, if all they saw of us was the Dick Van Dyke Show, the Mary Tyler Moore Show, Seinfeld, and you know, choose the next one that you like, you know, they would say, my God, how do you Yanks do such great work? In fact, that's what they do say, because they don't see your Mother the Car, or they don't see the terrible series that's probably premiering this week or next week and will be over in 2 weeks. So we only see their best; they only see our best. But I guess the thing about the British series that I like is that it's a very literate, writing and performing crew. It's a very literate audience that they're playing to. When Monty Python first went on, no one had a problem with the fact that they were referencing Nietzsche and Schopenhauer. They just figured, well, there are people out there in the audience, not everybody, but there are enough people out there who know what that stuff is. And, when you compare that to a lot of American series, perhaps before the Big Bang Theory, network television would shy away from, at first, and I'm talking maybe 20, 25 years ago, they would shy away from references that they thought were above the audience's head. So maybe it's the fact that there's just a more literate audience base, and therefore the performers and the writers can afford to be more literate. But there's also the sense that in the best of the British series, that there's as much pain and sadness in those series as there is comedy. And again, it's what I think is the best of comedy, is that it tells the truth about people. It tells the truth about humans. I mean, when you watch Ricky Gervais in his version of The Office, you see how sad a man he is. He's clueless. Right. He's not aware that he's sad, but you're aware that there's something really wrong. And while you're laughing at him, your heart still goes out to him. The same thing with his brilliant series on HBO called Extras. And the same thing. And there's a similar moments in Fawlty Towers, even though Fawlty Towers is very much in the style and the heritage of farce. There's this great moment in Fawlty Towers when Basil Fawlty, played by John Cleese, is sitting quietly in his office, licking his wounds, yet defeated another time. And he just quietly says to himself, well, that's your life. Do you get another one? No, mate. Phew, there it goes. It's just this it's this 10-second little monologue, little soliloquy, that, right, in which he dispenses with his artificial mask of arrogance, or as his wife says in the series, you're either kicking somebody or groveling. And he's just a human being. He's just a human being who's lost and who can't win, who can't figure out a way to win, and yet, is going to keep on trying. And there are a lot of great series like that in America too. The classic series of the Mary Tyler Moore Show, but there's Veep episodes on Showtime. I actually think that the best American comedy is done every night by Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert. So I'm really upset that Stephen Colbert got this big promotion, because
he's going to be playing himself or with no persona now, right?
Well, he's a really, really, funny and brilliant guy. So I don't think that he's going to be bad, but I do miss that all-purpose persona. Although I am looking forward to the new show that Jon Stewart's putting in that spot, which is Larry Wilmore and the Minority Report. So Larry Wilmore's a great writer. And in fact, the one sitcom that I've seen so far this year, not to date us, but you know, it's September, the end of September of 2014. The one sitcom I've seen so far that I really like is Black-ish. That's written and executive produced by Larry Wilmore.
Right, I've seen the previews for that. It looks extremely funny, and it's something definitely on my watch list. But you know, you mentioned Daily Show. That kind of, in my mind, touches on what you were speaking about earlier about the British comedy, which is it's you know, no matter what your politics are, it's intelligent. You know, he can find, you know, and his writers can find the humor in things without talking down to them. And that's what I think, again, makes it makes humor compelling is when there's a lot of intelligence attached to it.
Well, the real secret of The Daily Show is that they take these sometimes wonkish issues and they do make it clear and understandable to people who aren't following it, you know, minute by minute. But the other thing, the real secret is that the satire is not directed hostily at any one person or any one particular party. Although, you know, let's be frank, it certainly leans in a certain way. But where the comedy comes from is the interplay between the Jon Stewart's earnest yet often befuddled anchorman and his crew of completely idiotic reporters. And so they make their satiric points again through these human interactions and these human characters. So the satire goes down easily because it comes from a place of character and relationship, as opposed to here's another point I'm trying to make, which is one of the reasons that conservative comedy and conservative sketch shows have struggled to find the funny, not because their politics are not as good as the liberal politics, but because they kind of harp on, I think these guys are wrong, I think this is wrong, this is crazy, and they haven't created those characters who we get to know and laugh at and love. And that's really the genius of what Jon Stewart and all those people there at The Daily Show and Colbert Report have done. It's about character. It's everything flows from character, and the points that they make, the satiric points they make, are made through character.
Right, and I think your point about them, those characters endearing themselves to people is right on, because again, you know, not to get into politics here, but I think you're dead on your point, is that you know, you kind of got to romance it a little bit. If you're going to make your points, you got to romance it. You have to kind of come at it maybe from a different angle. You can't come head on all the time, because people, we all know people like this in our real life that maybe try to be funny and they're not, because they don't get the setup and the payoff, and they just come at it too hard.
Right. And also you can't, you know, when you're doing comedy, whether it's narrative comedy like a sitcom or a film, or it's solo comedy like stand up, the first person you have to make fun of is yourself. Because if you're pointing the finger at anybody else, that kind of relationship is hard to sustain in a comedic way. The first person you're making fun of is yourself. Even a stand-up like George Carlin is first creating this cranky old man character. First he was the kind of the, you know, stoned-out hippie character. So it's the character first, and then the observation that that character is making. And that's one of the reasons why Dice Clay, who was a good stand-up and a good actor, why he had problems is because he stopped making fun of that character, and that, you know, he's just started playing to the people who were not realizing that he was making creating a satirical character and just making fun of foreigners, which has a kind of a short half-life.
Tell me about your theater, I don't want to call it a theater troupe, but it was your comedic theater as a Manhattan punchline. Tell me a little bit about that.
That was great. We had this theater company that started in the 80s. I started it with two actors, Mitch McGuire and Faith Catlin. And we were just a knife's throw from the Port Authority. And it ran for 13 years, which is more time than most convicted murderers get. So it was a labor of love. It was a theater that was completely devoted to comedy. We did plays. We did stand-up shows. Rita Rudner debuted there. Dom Herrera. We did improv shows. Michael Patrick King debuted there, and Michael Patrick King later went on to write Sex and the City and now Two Broke Girls. We premiered shows by David Crane, did a little thing called Friends, Peter Tolan, David Ives, who won the Tony last year for, I think, Venus and Fur. So it was a great place. We had great actors there, too, Mercedes Rule and Oliver Platt. But it was not for profit, and little did I know it was what they wrote. And so it ran as best as it could for 13 years, and then we finally ran out of funding. We didn't run out of creativity, but we couldn't pay the rent.
What did you learn during that time, 13 years? What did you personally learn about comedy?
I thought I knew. I was a kid, and I was arrogant, the way kids are, who get into a position of authority. And I was the co-founder and artistic director, and I thought I knew everything there was to know about comedy. And then after doing it for a little bit, producing and directing and teaching classes, I thought to myself, okay, I don't know everything there is to know, but I know it's not funny, goddammit. Mm-hmm. And shortly after that, I had to come to realize that how the fuck does this stuff work? Why is something funny on a Thursday and the same exact thing, supposedly the same exact thing, is not funny on a Sunday? So that's really when the...
Why is that, though? I want to interrupt you there. That's a great question that you just put out there. Why is that, or what did you find about that? Because that's...
Found is that something, the actors would come off stage and say, what a terrible audience. But I would be back in the back of the house watching, and I noticed that they were doing something different on the nights in which they weren't getting laughs, that something was happening that they were not aware of. And so I started trying to explore this, create exercises and improv games to kind of get at what was going on, what is the hidden levers and fulcrums that no one's taught in college or acting school that is really creating the differences between successful performances and unsuccessful performances. And what came out of that was a 40-week masterclass in comic performance. And we started to come up with tools, not rules, but tools, things that you could use to fix a performance, or things that if you weren't doing it would sometimes let the performance go slack. So like the tool of winning, the idea that comedy gives you the permission to win, the tool of the non-hero, not a comic hero, not a clown necessarily, but simply somebody who lacks some, if not all, the required skills and tools with which to win. The tool of straight line, wavy line, the idea that there is no such thing as a straight man in a comic. There is, however, the idea that one character in a scene might have blinders on, like on a rail, like on a straight line, and another character struggling with that character, struggling with a problem. Somebody blind to the problem or creating the problem, and another character struggling with that problem. John Cleese said that when they started Monty Python, they thought that comedy was watching somebody do something silly. They later came to realize that comedy is watching somebody watch somebody do something silly. And so out of this came a 40-week masterclass in approach to comedy. And when I moved to Los Angeles, somebody came up to me somebody who I'd met through the HBO work I'd been doing, and he was working with Robert McKee. And he said, you know, I think he could do for comedy what Robert McKee does for story. And that started, you know, I said, yeah, sure. But that started it all. And, you know, within a few years, I was traveling to Singapore and New Zealand and Sweden. And last year I went to Kiev, thankfully, before the war. And so it just kind of you know, snowballed. And we published the book last year, The Hidden Tools of Comedy.
Now, but you originally taught, you were saying you were, it was an actor's class, and then you switched to writing. What, was it the same? I mean, how were you able
to? I don't think I really switched to writing. I switched to working with writers, only because I found that most actors were always broke, and you could only get, really, you could only, you know, you could only work with 15 of them at a time. Or else they couldn't get up and work. Whereas you could put 300 writers in a room and give the same material to them, and it was, you know, it would be, you know, make more financial sense, and it would always also work with a lot more people at the same time. Because what I've come to understand is that the basic principles of comedy are the same whether you're writing it, directing it, or performing it. You come at it with slightly different angles, but it's still the same way of telling the truth about people. It's still the same way of looking at a person who's struggling with insurmountable odds, without many of the required tools with which to win, yet never giving up hope. And that's the paradigm we use. That's what we call the comic equation. And out of that equation, you can draw tools that writers can use, directors can use. I know that they directors can use, because I've used them when I've directed theater, and actors can use.
So you just mentioned that you've got the Comedy Intensive, which is a writing seminar that that you put on from time to time, and people can find out about it on your website, which is what is it?
It's www.kaplancomedy.com. That's Kaplan with a K, comedy with a C, because I'm, you know, I don't play that with comedy with a K, because that's you know, that's low class. So it's kaplancomedy.com, and the 2-day comedy intensive is actually, it's geared mostly for writers, but I got to tell you, directors take it, actors take it, solo performers, stand-ups have taken it, executives and producers have taken it. So again, it's the exploration of what comedy is, how it works, why it works, what's going on when it's not working, and what can you do to fix it.
And then you also do script consultations. Can you talk a little bit about what you do for that?
That actually came out of doing these writing seminars. So I'm in the writing seminar in the 2-day comedy intensive. I illustrate these points by showing clips from good movies, good comedies, and not so good comedies, and then deconstructing. And showing everybody exactly why the scene isn't funny, what's going wrong, and more importantly, because everybody can, you know, can backseat drive, and hindsight is 20/20, what you could do to make it better, what they could have done if they were in the writer's room or working on set to have improved those moments. And out of that, people started coming up and saying, could you look at my script? And so I started doing script consultations. And then when I started going overseas, the funding organizations, most overseas film and television is funded by their governments. And so I started being asked by Film Australia and, you know, Film Victoria and Screen Australia and organizations in New Zealand and Sweden, producers and funding organizations there, to work on scripts with them. So scripts that I've worked on have appeared on Australian television. Actually, the script, the writer that I worked with, his sitcom, I think it's the Josh Thomas sitcom. I think it's Please Like Me. I think that's the name of it. Actually, was shown on an American station, American network here this past year. So I've worked for producers, I've worked for individual screenwriters, and then organizations and projects that I have signed NDAs on. So I can't tell you that I've worked on them, but I have.
Is there a format that you like? You know, so when you think about, and maybe I don't want to use the word incorrectly, but as far as format goes, but, you know, there's sitcoms, so television, theater, there's movies, there's stand-up. Do you have a preference, just your own personal, like, what you like to see and experience when you're sitting there as an audience member? And then what are the difference between those when you work with a writer?
Well, I mean, as an audience member, I got to tell you, I want to see things blow up because you know, there's a part of me that just becomes so critical when I'm watching just a pure comedy that you know, that I want the release of not having to look at something and deconstruct it in my head as I'm watching it. On the other hand, the things that I gravitate to have humor in them, like Guardians of the Galaxy. I thought it was very funny and so enjoyable, and what a fun ride. Whereas you know, something like you know, there'll be an episodic or an adventure show on television, I'll just stop watching it because it doesn't have a sense of humor. And you can't watch something that has no humor.
I have to name drop here for a second because we talked about Robert McKee earlier. He was actually one of in fact, for Curious About Filmmaking podcast, he was the first person I interviewed, and this was in conjunction with the ISA. So it was pretty funny, and we wound up talking about Guardians of the Galaxy as well. And he went on and on about it, how awesome it was. So yeah, you guys have that in common, just so you know.
Well, I'm glad that I agree with Robert, or Robert agrees with me. It followed the hero's journey very well, and it was funny to boot. I mean, I loved all those '80s tunes. When I work with a writer, I mean, you know, it's people say, okay, are you going to give me written notes? When I work with a writer, and I guess this comes from working as a director with playwrights, or as a producer with writers, it's a very dynamic situation. I don't come in with a bunch of answers and solutions. I come in with a bunch of questions, and 'cause my goal is to first figure out what's important to the writer. What's the writer's vision? Because oftentimes when you're getting a script in an early draft, the writer's vision has been clouded by any number of things. And you'll be reading a script, and the script really is three different movies. And so the first thing you got to figure out is, well, which is the movie the writer really wants to write? And how can I help make that movie come to life? How can I help that movie emerge from this draft? So I'll ask a lot of questions, and I will follow everything from the point of view of character, because the best comedies come from a great comic premise developed totally honestly and organically through character. So the premise is the big lie. The premise is the impossible or implausible thing that probably could never happen, or absolutely could never happen. But if it did happen, what would happen then? And then my job, or one of my jobs, is to just make sure that the actions that are taken are the actions that the characters want to take, as opposed to things that are imposed on them. That the dialogue is the dialogue the actors would say, or rather the characters would say, because a lot of times you'll see characters do things in a screenplay, and the question is why, and the answer is, well, I thought it would be funny if. And that's actually not the best way to write a comedy. Wouldn't it be funny if? Because one of the first things we talk about in the seminar is that there's a difference between comic and funny. Funny is what makes you laugh. If you're laughing at it, it's funny to you. If you're not laughing at it, it's not funny to you. So funny is subjective. So to just go on, wouldn't it be funny if, disconnected from character and what the character is trying to accomplish in the narrative, is kind of a, you're playing against the odds. Now you certainly have to serve your own sense of humor. And if you put something in that's funny and you think it's funny, fine. But at a certain point, and here's the other thing I tell writers is, you should at least take an improv class once in your life so you can experience what it's like to see through the eyes of a character, speak through the mouth of a character, hear through the ears of a character, experience the world the character sees, not the top-down world the writer sees as though they're pushing pawns around a chessboard. The other thing I tell them is they have to get into a writer's group. They have to hear their stuff read out loud. At a certain point, comedy only exists through the mouths of human beings into the ears of human beings. So you can focus too much on jokes, and if you think about great comedies, especially films, it's not the jokes you remember; it's the characters and the situation and the premise. Sitcoms are a little different. Sitcoms tend to be a little bit more joke heavy, but even there, the best sitcoms come out of character and situation, as opposed to, and here's a joke, and here's a joke, and here's a joke. One of my best friends is a stand up, and he's great at jokes. And he has a friend who's a showrunner, and he will send jokes to the showrunner, and the showrunner occasionally will send him back $50 or $100. The showrunner's not great at jokes. But the showrunner, his friend, is great at story and character. My friend isn't making the millions of dollars that the showrunner's making. So, to think that comedy's only about jokes is actually a mistake. And most people, I mean, it's got to be funny. There's no question about that. But you don't want to sacrifice who the characters are and what the reality is and what you're trying to go for in order to have a cheap laugh, because those cheap laughs will eventually work against you. So when I'm working on a script, we'll talk about premise, story, character structure, give page notes, sometimes give even line notes and pitch jokes at them. But the most important thing is the development of the premise, is that fulfilled by the characters, or is it left unfulfilled because you're putting in unnecessary and actually distracting quote unquote comedy bits?
Is there a type of student that's ideal for you? And what I mean by that is, you mentioned that you talked to them about, premise and structure and characters and story. Do you want them to have a pretty good working knowledge of all of those things before coming to you? In other words, it doesn't matter.
Well, I mean, people have come to me with scripts that they have written 12 times and they're going to shoot that summer. And when they come there, my job isn't to knock out the foundation of the house and have them, rebuilt from scratch. My job is, okay, they're going to shoot this in 2 months. What's the vital thing, the essential parts that can be fixed and should be fixed? And in those cases, I'm working with a scalpel, because I'm not out to tear the walls down and have them start again. I'm out to help them realize their vision as best as they can in the time that they have. Mm-hmm. People come to me with premises, and we'll talk about, well, how can you develop this? Where's the real story here? Who are the characters who are going to take this story down the road? Because all stories are developed through characters and theme, and a lot of people can write an entire script without ever knowing what the movie's about. I don't know what the theme is. I just know it's funny. But at a certain point, at some point, you got to know what the movie's about, because while premise is the engine that pushes you into the narrative, theme is the rudder, and theme has you make choices. I mean, the theme of Big, for instance, is what's the nexus between childhood and adulthood? And mm-hmm. because that's the theme, when Tom Hanks, you know, wanders into FAO Schwartz and meets a guy who's going to offer him a job, he meets a guy who runs a toy company as opposed to a guy who runs a gas station. Because a gas station doesn't really help you thematically, whereas a toy company does.
Well, Steve, I think we'll leave it there. I want to be respectful of your time. Again, I just want to make sure that people can find you. And again, your website is www.kaplancomedy.com. That's K-A-P-L-A-N.
They can email me at steve@kaplancomedy.com. They could friend me Facebook at Kaplan Comedy. And also, I'm on Twitter. SK Comedy is my Twitter handle. So tweet me.
There you go. All right, Steve, it was a real pleasure speaking with you today, and I'm sure we'll be talking with you again soon in the future. Thanks for joining us today.
It was a pleasure.